Good afternoon, everyone. I call the Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. I'll begin with the approval of minutes for March 14, 2024. Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I'll move the approval of the March 14, 2024 meeting minutes for approval.
Thank you. Chair Fisher moves the approval of minutes from March 14, 2024. Discussions. Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, the minutes for March 14, 2024 are now approved. Members, our first bill before us today is House File 2666. Representative Collins, welcome to the committee. I'll move your bill to be re-referred to Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. Please welcome to the committee and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Thank you, committee members. It's a pleasure to be here today. Today I'm presenting House File 2666, and please don't let the number of the bill scare you too much. It establishes a statewide basic income grant program that will serve as a demonstration project that unconditional cash payments made directly to families can work in every corner of the state. I first learned about the basic income program, the pilot program, when Mayor Carter launched a pilot in St. Paul in response to the pandemic. I got to hear some amazing testimony and stories from individuals who received that basic income and how it helped make their lives a lot better, help them find better jobs, help them have more time with their children, and also allowed them to meet their daily needs. So while today's testifiers are from my district in St. Paul, the bill is supported by a broad coalition of organizers that either have run basic income programs or are interested in the economic security of Minnesotans. And you can find those coalition supporters on the one-page handout that should be in your packet. You'll also find in your packet support letters from statewide coalitions like Homes for All, who believe that this can address housing insecurity. Springboard for the Arts ran a multi-site basic income pilot in the Twin Cities and in Otter Tail County and saw impacts on workforce development in greater Minnesota. And the International Institute ran a basic income program with immigrants and refugees who recently arrived in the country, getting them on their feet and on a pathway to better employment. And many more supporters who believe the program can uniquely impact Minnesotans with disabilities, American Indians, and more. The constant across all of these basic income pilots in the state and across the country is that it provides families and individuals with the freedom and flexibility to make economic decisions in their lives while at the same time improving workforce, child development, health, and other outcomes of well-being. This bill offers the state of Minnesota the opportunity to demonstrate that basic income works at a larger scale in more corners of the state with more constituency groups. Ultimately, we want to determine how basic income moves from pilot to demonstration to statewide policy. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Well, thank you so much. It's an honor to have the mayor of this great city, Mayor Melvin Carter. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Noor, members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you very much for having me here. My name is Melvin Carter, and I serve both as mayor of the city of St. Paul and as national co-chair of a national network of over 150 mayors called Mayors for a Guaranteed Income. Right now, the city of St. Paul is at the center of a nationwide conversation about how guaranteed income can help raise the income floor for our most vulnerable neighbors and provide them with the opportunity to achieve upward financial mobility. At the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, we leveraged CARES Act dollars to launch our People's Prosperity Guaranteed Income pilot, the first publicly funded guaranteed income pilot in the nation. Our pilot gave 150 low-income families $500 a month for 18 months with no strings attached, and the results were groundbreaking. These unconditional cash payments helped families pay rent, buy groceries, obtain child care, and get out of debt. Instead of scraping by month to month, several families were able to put money into savings for the first time. Contrary to the notion that a guaranteed income rewards laziness and drains the economy by discouraging work, we learned that those in our pilot program actually gained employment after receiving monthly payments. Data from our pilot showed that participants' employment grew from 49% at the beginning of the pilot to 63% 6 months after the program ended, a 14% increase. That's because the $500 a month allowed people to get childcare, to buy a new suit for a job interview, take time away from a part-time job to interview for a full-time job, or fix that broken tire, or address any number of barriers that keep people from fully participating in our economy. Anecdotally, but often an important indicator of sustained success, families reported a decrease in anxiety and depression, favorable levels of health, and increased feelings of hope even 6 months after the pilot ended. This sense of hope and resilience is a mindset we all lean on during challenging times. They are powerful sentiments that help us move forward. Critics of guaranteed income argue the same harmful narrative and disparaging tropes about what low-income people will do with a monthly cash benefit. But the data tells us, the independent third-party evaluation that we're doing, that we've done on our work, tells us they spend it how any of us would, on rent, on groceries, clothes for their children, and other daily necessities. Today, St. Paul is engaging in another pilot, College Bound Boost, that pairs guaranteed income with asset building via college savings accounts. We're looking forward to seeing the independent third-party evaluation results of that study as well. Mr. Chair, economic insecurity is not new. It is not a partisan issue, and it is certainly not limited to our metropolitan areas. Minnesotans of all walks of faith in every corner of this state struggle with the ability to meet their basic needs every month. As leaders here in Minnesota, we have the opportunity to change that narrative, to break cycles of generational poverty, to start raising the income floor for Minnesotans who need it, giving them the opportunity to thrive and step into their full potential as contributing members of our workforce and economy. In St. Paul, our guiding principle is rooted in building a city that works for all of us. If we're going to build a state that works for all of us, then we must ensure that no one who works full-time gets trapped in cycles of poverty or has to struggle to make ends meet. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as a Minnesotan who has grown used to deep economic inequality, to poverty, and to seeing children and families without the resources to afford basic necessities like food, shelter, health care, etc., I recognize that the approach that we're proposing is fundamentally different, is a fundamentally different approach to poverty alleviation than what we're used to. And I'll share with you, that's my favorite part of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mayor, for your testimony. I don't know if anyone has got a question for the mayor. He has got another commitment that he has to run to. Any questions for the mayor? Vice Chair Vaughn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Mayor. You know, I think you recall that you and I have faced across this table before a number of years ago when we were first talking about programs like this one, like and sort of creating that pilot to look at how we could get more kiddos into college, how we could raise that bar and expectation to get those kids there. And really create a different narrative around how we lift each other up instead of just continuing to do the same things we've always done, right? And you didn't say it in your testimony, but I know that there were a number of programs in other states that have tried some similar concepts to what we're talking about here. I wonder if you could just briefly, I know we want to keep going, but if you could just briefly speak to what some of the results have been in those areas and how that would has informed our decision making in terms of this program.
Mayor,
Chair, no representative, thank you so much for that question. I alluded to my national work as a co-chair, as a founding co-chair of Mayors for a Guaranteed Income. That work, again, has grown from St. Paul being the second city to launch a mayor-run guaranteed income pilot, the first, as I said, with public dollars, to seeing over five dozen other communities follow in our footsteps and do that same thing. We've launched a Center for Guaranteed Income Research out of the University of Pennsylvania that helps us to conduct that third-party independent evaluation that I was talking about that demonstrates our ethic that getting this right is more important than being right. We want to make sure that we're showing our work where that's concerned. We have colleagues across the country who have done guaranteed income pilots that are focused on many things. Ours is combined with our guaranteed our college savings accounts initiative, which many of you are all aware of. We've seen pilots around the country that have focused on foster care youth. We've seen pilots that have focused on single moms, single dads. Columbia, South Carolina, for example, focused theirs on single dads, low-income single dads, and found that 60% of the dollars went straight to child support. And again, this is a strong counterpoint against some of the racist and classist and sexist tropes about what, quote unquote, those people will do if you give them money. We find low-income Americans, when they have money, it goes to rent, it goes to food, it goes to health care, it goes to those children. And that's those are results that we are seeing repeated in study after study after study across the nation. This is an exciting year for us because we're going to be almost having independent evaluations from around the country drop almost every month. And so we're excited to see. But so far, again, we've got a number of studies in a row that demonstrate particularly that outcome that I told you about where employment is concerned. Stockton, California, the city in front of us did a randomized control trial, and they found that members of their experimental group gained employment at twice the rate of members of their control group who did not have the resource. And so that's one outcome that I'm very confident that I can look you in the eye and say that we have at least 3 to 4 independent third-party evaluation studies in a row that demonstrate that these dollars, Americans don't use these dollars as an excuse to work less. They take advantage of them as an opportunity to work more.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair and Mr. Mayor. I think it's really fascinating to see how some of these explorations have gone and where they're leading us to. And I think what it really demonstrates is that, to your point, when we give people a hand up, we really, really lift up families. And I think that it has been, that's what we're seeing in a lot of these studies and this work across the country and here. And it's really encouraging to see that when given the opportunity, that we all love our families. We all love our kids, right? And we're willing to step up and make a better life for our families. So I really appreciate that. And I know it sometimes runs counter to the narrative we hear out in the world, but I'm really grateful for the work and I'm grateful for the results.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You referenced a study. What were the start and end dates for that study?
Mayor Cutt.
In St. Paul, Representative? Mr. Chair, Representative, we started our first pilot in, I believe, October of 2020 was our first distribution of resource to our first participants, and it was an 18-month study, so a year and a half portion, and they did a 6-month look back, so 2 years after that would have been the timeline.
Thank you. And you referenced increased level of employment, so you've got the data on initial percent that were employed, and then you also had data on more fully employed, so maybe they worked, you know, 10 hours or a part-time, but they were able to get a full-time. I'm trying to understand exactly the data.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I shared was at the start, at the onset of our pilot, 49% of the participants were actively employed, and at the end of our pilot, 18 months later, that number had risen by a 14% to 63%.
Okay. What were the initial unemployment rates at the point of you first started with and then ended? And do you have data on the amount of, you know, partially fully employed? Because a big thing, especially with training, is now you can get another job, so now you can be fully employed. I remember working 3 part-time jobs, and I've worked some full-time jobs, and generally the full-time jobs have benefits and they're, you know, better pay and stability. And so I'm trying to understand the increase in stability. If you can offline maybe send that data so that we can look at that and better understand it? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have all of that data at my fingertips right now. I can guarantee you we've got folks in the room who can get you more data and evaluation reports than you probably care to read, but we'll make sure that we'll get it all to you.
And if that is possible, Mayor, I think it should be sent to our committee administrator so that it can be shared with all the members.
Mr. Chair, representatives, as a mayor, as someone who's been involved in policymaking for quite some time, one of the things that makes this a delight, this body of work a delight for me, is that I very, very rarely get to take action on policies that have as much independent evaluation as we're prepared to demonstrate around this work. That's something that's very exciting for us, and I think an enormous opportunity for this committee and for our state government as well. We will absolutely get that information to you.
I have two more people on the list, Representative Keeler, followed by Lee Newbrin. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins and Mayor, for being here. I'm a co-author on this bill because I see this really as preventing homelessness. We heard this in the Children and Family Committee, and I think one of the things that was really powerful after that, talking to some of the people that have been supportive of this, is not only just the job increase, but this dollar amount, you know, offsets for some people not to have to work second or third jobs, which we talk so much about the importance of parents being a part of our child's lives as we raise them. And many of us digging out of poverty work so much that we kind of lose that opportunity to be a hands-on parent because we have to keep a roof over our head. And so one of the questions I was going to ask, you kind of already answered on, like, what are some of the things that people are spending their money on? You know, cars, daycare, like transportation, housing, savings. You know, we talk a lot about, like, Dave Ramsey will tell us we're supposed to have $1,000 in our savings account for an emergency, when it's hard to do that when sometimes you can't even pay the light bill, right? And so I do appreciate that, and I'm glad you kind of answered that question. The one question that I have as a safe harbor advocate, making sure that we protect you know, our youth and young adults from sex trafficking, when we do programs like this, can you walk us through how maybe you just heighten awareness or make sure that your staff or individuals who are part of this program also are aware of the signs of sex trafficking and how we can address that in programs like this?
Mayor Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you so much for your support. Thank you for being a co-author, and thank you for the question. That's a very critical question for us because we know that we do have people in our communities, all of our communities, who would love to prey on our young people. While I'll have to get you a follow-up answer on some of the more specific elements, the work that we do as we engage young people always includes, where this is concerned, kind of personal empowerment, workforce training, some of those kind of well-being types of initiatives, and you know, we'll follow up to engage on specifics around the safe harbor work how we ensure some of those things. But I think that's a critical question.
Representative,
thank you,
Lee Newbrin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mayor Carter, for being here. I really appreciate it. My question is, I'm wondering if you can talk to, and I apologize, I came in a few minutes late, so you may have already addressed this, but I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about how the city of St. Paul specifically administered the program. Did the city administer it directly? Did you work through nonprofits? How did you choose to administer this program in the city of St. Paul?
Mayor Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. In my first or second, I believe, year as mayor, we established in the city of St. Paul an Office of Financial Empowerment. Our goal is to just help families make money work well for themselves. We're very proud of our AAA stable credit rating that we have as a city, and we've decided that it's not good enough to just stop at managing the city's as an entity's dollars really well. We want to make sure that our community members know how to manage their money well and make money work well for them. So when we decided in the wake of the pandemic that this was the type of intervention that we wanted to lean in on, we already had a team that was prepared to be able to administer this. They had administered emergency grants to families, for example, during the pandemic. And so this was administered through our Office of Financial Empowerment, by our Office of Financial Empowerment staff. And to be clear, as I say, that I'm fully aware that the vast majority of the dollars went to basic necessities like food, clothing, things like that. It's because it was administered by giving families a debit card, which was charged with $500 a month. And so because it was through a debit card, that's why we can so clearly track how the dollars were spent.
Lee Newbrin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. That is really helpful. My other question for you is, if you know, you had mentioned this increase, a 14% increase in employment. Now, it sounds like you started in 2020. So I'm wondering if you have the data on what's the comparison between the folks who were on this program and folks who were not on this program for employment? Because obviously this is coming out of the pandemic. Unemployment was really high across the board. And so I'm wondering if we have that data more broadly, too.
Mayor Cardo, Representative Hollins.
I just want to note that I actually had additional testifiers who might have more data, and the mayor actually has to leave. I know. You want to take it?
I can't respond.
Okay.
So, Representative Hollins, you want to excuse your mayor?
Right. I do have another appointment, and I appreciate that, Representative. Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. Where the St. Paul evaluation data is concerned, I don't have a control group to compare that 14% against, which is one of the reasons why I did share that, again, our partner city, Stockton, California, they did that randomized control trial, which is that kind of highest level that compares an experimental group to a control group. That's the city that I mentioned already that found that members of the experimental group were twice as likely as members of their control group. I'll say more specifically, families who got the benefit were twice as likely than families who did not get the benefit to increase their employment during the course of the study. I mentioned a handful of studies in a row that have demonstrated, that have repeated this outcome of increased employment participation. I think at least three of those have been randomized control studies. And I also mentioned our College Bound Boost program that we're running right now that I said I'm looking forward to the evaluation of. The evaluation we're doing on that is a randomized control study as well. And so while I don't have the specific control group to compare that 14% against, your question is right on. The question isn't just were we able to ride a wave or not. The question is have we been able to make a difference or not? And we do have a significant amount of data that demonstrates that we are making a difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Carter.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mayor. I know this is a big topic for all of us. It's about poverty and how we address poverty in our state and nationally. So thank you so much, Mayor, for being here today.
Thank you all.
The next person is Manager Woodridge. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Casey Wiedrich, and I am the Financial Capability Manager for the City of St. Paul's Office of Financial Empowerment, and I manage the city's two guaranteed income programs that Mayor Carter referred to. And so we provided 483 St. Paul residents with unconditional $500 a month for 18 and 24 months, respectively. And I've also provided guidance and technical assistance to almost 10 other basic income programs in Minnesota, as well as over a dozen cities across the country. So I thank you for this opportunity to testify on House File 2666. So today I'll walk you through the bill, and there's both a bill summary and a one-pager in your materials, which provides details about the bill, so feel free to look at either of those. So the bill will establish a statewide competitive grant program through the Department of Human Services to provide regular unconditional cash payments to eligible Minnesotans. Grant applicants must be a local government, a tribal government, or a nonprofit organization across Minnesota. And DHS will follow the grant-making policies and procedures outlined in state statutes to protect public funding. This competitive grant structure allows for local communities to design their own programs to best meet their community's specific needs and goals in both rural, urban, and tribal settings. Grantees would provide monthly payments to participants of at least $500 for at least 18 months. Eligible recipients include individuals or families with incomes at or below 300% of the federal poverty level, or those receiving other public benefits, but grantees would also have the flexibility to set other eligibility requirements. This bill also directs DHS to evaluate the program through an independent evaluator and to establish a community of practice, which allows the state not only to understand the efficacy of the program, but to gather lessons on how best to implement flexible cash support to different populations in different communities. As I have administered basic income payments over the past 3 years, I've witnessed how they have helped families make ends meet day to day, but also work towards their long-term goals by taking a training to qualify for a better job or to save to buy a house. but to also experience joy because they have a little bit more money and they can buy cupcakes for their children for their birthday party. A statewide basic income program will expand these opportunities to thousands more Minnesotans. Thank you again for this chance to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you so much. If you can stay close by, we'll call the next testifier, Leandra Estes. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, I am Leandra Estes. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. So good afternoon to you all. I am Leandra Estes. I am a descendant of the historic Rundle community. I am now a homeowner in the Frogtown community up here in St. Paul. Thank you, Chair Knorr, Representative Hollins, and all of the committee for this opportunity to testify again on this file 2666 and share my experience with St. Paul College Bound and College Boost, a guaranteed income program. So I learned about the program upon giving birth to my now two-year-old son. And after birth, they introduced you to College Bound program. As an advocate for my children and for myself, I immediately took interest in the program. And through navigating through the simple process and then making some phone calls just for follow-up questions, I was introduced to College Boost, which is the basic income program that guarantees $500 monthly payments. I now stand before you as a College Boost parent, advocate, ambassador, and committee chair representative. Wearing these titles are my proud duty to serve as a link, a recruiter, and an educator to the program. College Boost has changed my life impressively. It has provided me with the means to save intentionally, which is something I have not been able to do since becoming a homeowner 5 years ago. College Boost provided me an emergency account. In the past few days, my son came down with influenza B, double ear infections. Don't worry, I'm not contagious. I got tested this morning. So you're all safe. Yes, he came down sick. He also battles with asthma and eczema. But, of course, that meant I had to go get medication, right? Yeah. Government covers so much. But then there's those non-over-the-counter prescriptions, like your Tylenols and ibuprofens, your cough syrups that I had to purchase. I still have days till payday. Had nothing but gas money. Doctor's office is way out Egan. What am I going to do? College Boost. I remember. I have my card. I can get gas. And I can get my son's medication. And I can also get him some soup that he's going to need to get better. College Boost has also afforded me the ability to send my daughter to an HBCU college tour that will happen this fall, which is an experience of a lifetime. And it has afforded me to be able to pay off my past due child care bills. This past winter, I was able to purchase 4 new tires for our transport needs. And most dear to my heart, College Boost blessed me with the affordability to purchase a large sofa rather than the small love seat that I had. That sounds very heinous, and I know. But imagine being with your family as your brother is dying of pancreatic cancer, given 6 months to live. Within 5 months, he has gone from a 240-pound person to my size, 130. Literally whittling away. His passions is to be with his family, and that's all we wanted to do, be with him every day. With this affordability, I was able to buy that sofa, being the only homeowner of my family, have all of my family there, and be with my brother in his dying days as he hospiced at home.
Take your time.
My brother was surrounded with love, support, and gratitude. He's a hero to us. The last time I was here, I testified that College Bound, College Boost gives an individual hope. It brings joy, security, and most of all, it allows us to believe that our dreams will become reality. It is my duty to state that College Boost, with flexible funds and flexible spending, it helps one to build value of self, increasing our self-worthiness. It creates opportunity, provides, protects, and helps us to invest. There are programs like you have your government assistance, you have other programs, but they're all monitored. You can't, if you call and you say that you need help with something, one of the questions is, do you have a vehicle? Sell your vehicle. They will tell you to sell your vehicle in order for them to help you to pay your rent. Having this program that allows you to bring in income that's not restricted and be able to spend non-restricted is very important to us. It is that tattle the fence of being able to survive seriously. I would not have been able to bring my family together. We would not have been able to share those moments if I did not have the access to this program. Again, I thank you, Chair Knorr, Representative Holland, and thank you to all the members. And any questions you may have?
Thank you so much, and I'm sorry for your loss, and thank you for sharing your story with us. Member discussions. Lee Newbrinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. I do have several questions on the bill. And as I look through the bill, there are certainly several things that stick out to me. And I'm wondering how this all works together. I notice on line 2.26, you're talking about eligible recipients of the payments, not of the grants. So these would be the folks who are receiving the payments. A recipient must attest to the recipient's need. And then it goes on to say they must be receiving public benefits. And if they are, that would indicate some level of documentation already, right, if they're receiving public benefits. It says, or have a household income less than or equal to 300%. I don't see any other requirements for verifying that income. Are there other, am I missing something, or is there a requirement for verification beyond the attestation?
Representative Hawley.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Thank you, Representative Newbrinley. So there is not a requirement in the general bill. Now, we did say that's the floor of what we were expecting, and that the organizations or municipalities that are giving out, who are administering these payments could have different requirements. That being said, it is an ongoing conversation that has been brought to our attention. I think that one of the things that we've talked about with the advocates who or the organizations that have worked on this before was that the level of trust and also administrability when looking at these particular grants, because when we start having people providing documentation, especially confidential information, it becomes a lot more difficult to, the cost of administering it goes up a bit. But it is something that we've had ongoing conversations about, because there are differing opinions on what those requirements should be. So I'm open to having a conversation, and I don't know if my testifier has more to add.
Ms. Ridberg.
Yes, thank you, Chair and Representatives. Just to add that I think the attestation is built in, sort of as you're saying, that the core on the guaranteed income is dignity and choice for families and the trust in families to make their best decisions. So we try to build that into the administration of it and really reduce the administrative burden on families to enroll as much as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I will just say it's a little conflicting that it's true it's the floor, and that these organizations could ask for additional information, but the list of must not require is also pretty significant, right? That they can set other eligibility requirements. But it still can't, I mean, it can't include identifying documentation, which means that they're still not going to be able to verify that kind of thing. So it feels like that's still really confining. Another question, line 2.29, it says an eligible recipient may be an individual or a family. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about this, because for the vast majority of the benefits we provide, it is based on a household income, because we don't want to be in a situation where the household income is $100,000 a year, but there is an individual in the house who could, on an individual level, be below that 300%. How does that play out, and why that distinction?
Representative Hollins, we'll be voting this bill out by 2:45, so we've got Chair Pryor, Quam, and Gilman waiting on the list. So
it's an expensive bill. I hope we give it the time it deserves.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Thank you, Representative New Brindley. I think that's a really good point. I think the intent of the language was to say that it doesn't have to be a family, which is why we were saying 300% of the poverty level could be for that individual, or 300% for the size of whatever family it is. But I'll also defer to my testifier to see if there's more detail on that.
Yeah, I think the intent of that, thank you, Representative, the intent of that is that it, not specifying that it has to be, say, families with children, that it could also be individuals to have flexibility in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. So that's something you might want to clean up. You might want to say, be clear about household income, mm-hmm. as opposed to individual or family, because that's how we determine most benefits, right, is by household income. That would be important. Question on why you came to the decision, and I appreciated Mayor Carter, you know, they have, I mean, the Office of Financial Empowerment, so they have an entire structure within the city to manage this kind of thing. However, this is much more broad. It can go to government entities, tribal governments, and nonprofits. What kind of controls, let me say it differently. I don't see a lot of controls in here on monitoring how that has happened, other than the self-report from these organizations.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I don't think I quite understand what the question is, but I will say that we noted that DHS will use the policies and procedures outlined in Minnesota statute for the grant-making policies to protect those public funds. So the legislation that we put into effect last year, following that shall not be named, situation.
Oh, it fell.
Not by me. And I think one of the, for me, one of the things that was appealing about it was, you know, when we brought in folks who were testifying from Otter Tail, the reality is I don't know what is happening in Otter Tail. I don't know what the community is like there. And so we really wanted to make this a little bit broader for the communities, nonprofits, organizations, municipalities that are in those locations in greater Minnesota who understand the community a little bit better and have the need, understand the need a little bit better, so that we're not, you know, reigning from on high saying this is who this should go to. We understand what your community is like. The reality is, right, I represent St. Paul. I know what St. Paul is like. I know the organizations in St. Paul and how our municipality functions, but I don't know how your community works. And so we really want to try to build those bridges and allow those local organizations and communities to be a part of this, and to also, you know, identify where that need is and also what that criteria looks like for that community.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that. There's a difference between a local municipality or a tribal government. They are accountable to their constituents, right? There is a built-in accountability because of the fact that they hold election certificates. And if they are screwing around with large amounts of money, they're going to pay for it at the ballot box with their constituents, right? I'm very concerned about the lack of controls on nonprofits and the lack of, I understand this idea of dignity and choice and trust, but we're the government. It's our job to trust but verify. And we're missing the verify piece. in this language. And I would just say, you know, we did see with Feeding Our Future, we saw nonprofits pop up, give us a list of kids they were feeding that didn't exist, and take the money. Under this language, I don't see a control on that. Because it is all self-attestation, there is no documentation required. There's no reason that we don't have a situation where a nonprofit pops up, gives us a list, hey, here's our list of people that don't actually exist. We need to trust but verify. We need documentation. I mean, I like the piece where, you know, they must be receiving public benefits. It's that, or that's the problem, right? That it's exclusively self-attestation. It's our job to track. And if all we're doing is trusting, we're not doing our job. And we're talking about a lot of money. So I'll close with this. We're talking about $100 million. To be clear, this is $100 million that we don't have. We are already, I said this the other day, we're trying to rebrand this idea of a structural imbalance. A deficit by any other name is still a deficit. A structural imbalance is a made-up term for this. And what that means is that we don't have $100 million to spend. We just don't. If we spend this $100 million now, it's adding to the bottom line problem in the next biennium that we already know we have. And we're doing that in this bill particularly with no controls on that money, with no data, no verification, no requirements. $3 million is allowed to be used for outreach, technical assistance, training, and evaluation. There's no limit on how much can be used for the administration of the program. And we're talking about a lot of money that we don't have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hollins, and then we'll go to the next.
Thank you, Sharon Knorr. I just wanted to thank Representative New Brindley. And actually, I'm totally willing to work with you on some of tightening up the language a little bit to have a little more controls in there and safeguards in place. So I'm not opposed to that.
Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I first, just the comment that your testifiers, I'm so glad I was here in committee today to hear that combination of folks that you brought today. Certainly, our host mayor here and his words and his way of putting things into a context that helps them understand the big picture. You know, the data and the technical person that can answer our questions, but then also someone that can speak from experience so that we in our minds can see this program working. And those examples and the details together give us a whole picture that is so important for understanding the basis of good legislation. So thank you for bringing this group together and allowing us and presenting this bill. So then my question that I'm kind of leading up to is this, you know, one thing that I know that is central to this is the idea that this is not just, oh, let's try it and who knows what's happening, we tried, but that we set it up as keeping to study the results of what's happening. As Mayor Carter said, it's not we want to be right and so we only want evidence that shows we're right. It's we want to be proven right. So no, that's not what we're after here. We want to know that this is the right avenue to follow up on and this is the right way to administer these kind of programs is unrestricted dollars. It's a hypothesis that we're testing out in the real world and we have good results so far. Where do we see, because it's the right, what do we see it, if you can kind of talk at a higher level about what will it be better than? So kind of we're saying this is a way of, you know, addressing real needs in society and supporting people in a way that's most effective. What are the things that you see that we might be doing now that it could eventually be replacing or shifting or changing and so you'd see reductions in other kinds of areas? And I'm just asking for your thinking at this point so that we can start thinking and also kind of creating that part of the conversation too.
Representative Collins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Pryor. So you know, I guess I'm going a little off script, but from my perspective, what I'm really interested in is, you know, when we look at this, who does it impact and how does it impact? And we know that there are so many people who are struggling. There are people who are elderly, who are struggling on a fixed income. There are people who are new families who are struggling with buying diapers and formula. And we know there are folks who are just starting out in their career who maybe are struggling to find work or to be fully employed. And so to my mind, I really would like to figure out who in this realm functions better with this flexibility and ability to dictate where that money is spent, as opposed to a more rigid system that says, oh, you're struggling? Okay, great, let's give you SNAP benefits. Or you're struggling, let's make sure you have housing assistance. Because maybe that's what you need, and maybe that's helpful, but maybe it's not, right? And we know that people need different things, and that varies across geography as well. Housing might be really easy to find in one community, but, you know, very difficult to find a job in that community, or vice versa, right? And so I think having the flexibility of this money is really what's important here. And by doing programs like this, we get to learn more about what people are going to spend their money on and how that impacts their well-being. And not just their well-being, but I think there's a real argument to be made that it impacts the well-being of any children or family members that are living with them by raising their mental health and also their like standard of living to a place where it is creating better opportunities for other folks. I mean, we had a testifier who says her daughter is getting to go on a tour of historically black colleges and universities, right? And that's something that she would not have had the opportunity to do before. That also means that she has gonna be able to have her eyes open to opportunities that she wouldn't normally have had, which means that she might go to one of those schools and then further increase and get out of like generational poverty, right? And so I think we can't underestimate how important that flexibility is in spending, because we don't know where it's going to go. And actually what I would love to see is sort of a longitudinal study on this, because I think it's gonna have impacts beyond just the people who receive the money, but actually for generations to come. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you might have anything to add.
Representative Kwan, and I know I said 2:45. That was a mistake. So that's why I gave you a little bit of a leeway, but go ahead, quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking over the actual language, must not require any proof of residency or citizenship or identifying documentation. And then it also has, attesting to. So I've been on the Legislative Audit Commission for many years, and I've seen a lot of fraud. The Feeding Our Future, hundreds of millions of dollars, and they had more documentation and information required for those programs. If you don't require identifying documentation, you have no idea who they are. And if all that's required is for them to say, I attest to the need, we've got dozens and dozens of people with the Feeding Our Future with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of fraud of where they were going to help children and they didn't. All that money was to help and it didn't, because we didn't have appropriate requirements, tracking, documentation, etc. And this bill, the way it's written, specifically prohibits the required documentation to be able to have any proof of anything. What is the 300% of poverty level for an individual in a family of four?
I could look that number up. I think it's around, thank you, Chair and Representative. I think it's around 84,000, 83,000. We could provide that afterwards, the exact number.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that's for the individual. The whole thing is, a key point on this is we're going up to this level of 300. And whenever we've seen bills that said we're going to have 200% of. We actually have the documentation of that figure and amount, so we know exactly. You know, I don't think that this, I understand the intent, but if we're going to do something and make sure that we actually help people, you need to do the background information to have the data right in front so the committee members know exactly, and you need to look at past experiences and have appropriate safeguards, because it makes me cry to think all the children that we could have helped but couldn't because of the past fraud. So that's why I push so hard to make sure we prevent that, because I want to help people. I don't want people becoming millionaires through this, and I don't see the checks and balances built in here to prevent that.
I think Representative Hollins is nodding ahead, so I'm sure she'll be working with you to address those issues. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. This question is for, is it Casey? Mm-hmm. The manager of the program. So the pilot program that was administered, and hearing the mayor also talk about, we have the data that shows where the money was spent because it was a debit card that was used. Is that correct?
Yes. The card allows us, for privacy reasons, we can't see everyone's individual transaction, but the bank is able to share aggregate level of where people are spending the money. So we get reports on the merchants of where folks are spending the money.
Representative Gilmer.
So, and can they spend the money anywhere they choose, because it's an extra $500 that was added to their, well, it wasn't actually added to their income, but it was added to their.
Yeah,
Ms. Goodrich.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. The St. Paul's program provided it on a card, and we use the same type of card that I believe the state uses for child support. It's a U.S. Bank government issue card. So people are able to spend it any place that would take a debit card.
Representative Gill.
Thank you.
Final follow-up.
Thank you. So here's my follow-up, and here's something that I just want to talk about as well. So could that indeed be used by like a minor? Like, could a child take and use that card when they're out grabbing groceries or going places, things like that? Or is it only the person that it's issued to that the card would be able to be used?
Manager Whitworth.
I would think, thank you, Representative. I think if the child had the PIN number and the store allowed a minor to purchase it, I think it could. We wouldn't have control on who, you know, once the card is in the hand of the participant. We do have, I would say, the way our program was administered, if a participant ever lost the card, we did have the ability to shut it off internally very quickly. So people could call us if there was ever a question of fraud. We could shut that card off from the city. And transfer it to a new card and safely get it to that person. So we did have those controls and were able to do that quickly so that people had access to their funds. But again, that there weren't just sort of lost cards floating out there that would have, you know, people would pick up and just spend the funds.
So here's my follow-up really quick.
We're almost done with the time for this bill.
I know, but this is very important. This is $100 million. And so from what I'm hearing you say, it's just like a debit card. So it could be used at the gas station, liquor store, CBD, cannabis store. It could be used anywhere, you know, could be used to buy tobacco, could be used to buy anything. And I don't see any guardrails in this bill that would prohibit the use of it being used in that way.
Ms. Woodward, Manager Woodward.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. No, the point of it is the unrestricted so that people can spend it how they want. And as Mayor Carter said, we have seen in the data that people are not spending it. They're spending it at for food and the other places. They're spending it at Target, at Costco, grocery stores, household items. So we aren't seeing liquor stores. I think the data that did look at it was maybe below 1% on vice spending. So I think that's been really consistent in St. Paul's program and just all of the programs that have tracked data. And there is a dashboard. The Stanford Basic Income Lab has been tracking those payments across a number of different programs, and all that data is publicly available on their website.
Thank you.
So I know this bill is going to the economic development area, and we're running out of time. With all due respect, I just wanted to bring this bill to a vote so that we can vote it out. I know other people have got, there are many members from both sides. I didn't want to continue with the, We'll give the two last people, Vice Chair Varner, but only one question. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question is all I have. On lines 3.2, Representative Hollins, we are talking any other income, proof of residency or citizenship, or identifying documentation of any recipient. And then on 3.6, 3.7, or individuals and families who have recently relocated to Minnesota or other states or countries. So as I've watched this bill in other committees, we do know that this bill, the funding, the $100 million, looks as if it could be funding those who are here illegally. So my question to you is, why should my constituents, or really any other taxpaying Minnesotan, pay for another benefit that benefits illegal aliens?
I will take it back. We do not call individual illegals in this committee. So I just wanted, with all due respect, I don't want to cut anybody out, don't want to call any human being illegal.
Mr. Chair,
that's my
philosophy. The Department of Homeland Security uses the word illegal aliens.
If they are here in this country illegal,
they are illegal aliens.
We do not call any human being illegal.
They're here illegally.
But you asked the question. I'll let the testifier respond. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. It's a simple answer because immigrants are paying taxes too. And the number that I've seen is $5.8 billion in taxes that are paid by immigrants, whether they are here lawfully or not. The reality is they contribute to our workforce, they contribute to our communities, and for that reason they are included in this. Their tax dollars are mixed in with your constituents' tax dollars.
Vice Chair Brian, for the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will just say, you know, I think when this program started, it was there was sort of a public-private partnership that evolved. And the point at that time was really to create sort of a proof of concept, if you will, to see if this could be scalable, for example. And one of the important parts about that, and one of the things that I emphasized at the time, was this ability to make it scalable so that we could actually bring it outside of the metro area, but also into greater Minnesota. That was really important to me. And in that process, I just want to be clear on a couple of things. On, you know, sort of that reporting and the metrics, I think that was really emphasized in the presentation today. And, you know, as far as the data, and we want to be careful that we are not equating things that happened in other areas of government to what's happening here. For example, in this particular issue, we have those specific debit cards. So we know these people exist. We know where they're spending the money. We have reporting and data that shows that. We're not talking about third-party folks that where we're just taking their word for it. There are limits set on the card on how much they can spend in a given time. So there is some basic parameters and controls. So I just want to be clear about that. And one of the important things about doing this as a proof of concept is that we're able to adjust our processes. We're able to retool. We're able to see what's working and what's not, and then make it scalable so that we can bring this to families across the state. But I just want to give you a quick couple of figures and I will move on. But 76% of employed people right now cannot afford an expense of about $500. That's from Motley Fool or Forbes, depending on where you want to do it. And what we know is that If we don't have that money, that puts people in debt. 44% of those folks don't even have $1,000 in the bank. 35% would have to borrow the money. 21% go on a credit card. 10% borrow from money. 4% have to go through a personal loan. And when you can barely afford the rent, adding that on top of everything else is a real problem, right? And we talked about the idea that employment went up during this study, and let's be specific about that. When you have a family where you can afford to pay your rent and have a house over your head, that affects government services, right? That affects homelessness. When the key to a job is the ability to have transportation, so when you have a flat tire, when you need to make sure you pay your car insurance so that you can get to work and feed your family, that $500 goes a long way, right? And I think we see that kind of coming out in this activity. And so I just wanted to center that for us, that we are seeing that folks are actually using it in exactly the ways we thought they would, and how valuable that has been in raising people up and raising them out of poverty. You know, I am very lucky. I will tell you, my family, until I was the age of 3, we lived in a trailer park behind Buck Hill. My parents were young. They worked the night shift. They had virtually no money. But here's the difference. My family had really close connections with family who could afford to help them. It was my grandfather who eventually helped my parents get a house, to build generational wealth, to be able to make sure that I had the clothes I needed and the food on the table. But not every family is that fortunate. And so I think we keep talking about doing things the same way, but we have to explore ideas on how to change that narrative and lift people up. We talk about living our values and how we want Minnesota to be the best place to raise a family. But we can't do that unless we're willing to ask hard questions and explore new ways to do that. And so I want to thank you, Representative Hollins, for this bill. I want to thank all of the folks to our testifier who have done the hard work of putting together this data and walking through this proof of concept for us, and really trying to work towards something that's scalable that could make a meaningful difference for Minnesota families.
With your closing remarks.
Super fast. I just want to thank everybody for constructive criticism on both sides of the aisle. They are all things that I'm going to look into and see if we can tighten the language up a little bit. And I appreciate the time and energy that that this committee took to hear this bill. So thank you so much.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 266 be re-referred to Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. You're on your way to the Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. The next bill is Representative Plotty, House File 4883. As Representative Plotty comes to the testify table, I will move the bill on her behalf, that House File 4883 be referred to Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Please proceed with the introduction of the bill.
Thanks, Chair Noor and committee. As you know, communities across Minnesota are facing an unprecedented mental health challenges. And Dakota County has responded by developing a continuum of effective services based on national best practices. And it's seen as one of the leaders in the state in both crisis response and follow-up. In fact, Minnesota Department of Human Services, DHS, wrote in their statewide crisis report, Dakota County is an exemplary example. Dakota County leaders are working with close partnership with public service systems such as police, EMS, fire, 9/11, as well as mental health providers, healthcare systems, community partners, justice systems, and people with diverse lived experiences. This approach focuses on bringing everyone together to tackle the issue because mental health and addiction impacts everyone. So I understand from conversations with Dakota County that much of the crisis service expansion has been funded by one-time dollars from, you know, especially with funding from the American Rescue Plan. And long-term, we need to make sure that these services have sustainable funding and a sustainable funding stream for statewide and all communities. And then in short, state support is needed to continue these critical services while longer-term work happens. And I also have a couple testifiers here, Chair.
Well, thank you so much. I can see the former chair of the Human Services is back here. Commissioner Halvorsen, welcome to the committee. Please proceed. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. It's great to be back in the House. It's great to be back in this committee. I worked with so many of you over the years and appreciate all you do, especially during deadline week. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 4883, and I'm very grateful to Representative Clardy to bringing this bill forward. I'm joined today by Evan Henspeter, who's Director of County Social Services at Dakota County. As you heard, in response to growing mental health needs, especially that our law enforcement was seeing, and the crisis interventions that were needed, Dakota County invested a lot of dollars, millions of dollars, much of it one-time money, into building up that piece of the continuum, the crisis piece of the continuum. We invest all along the mental health continuum, from prevention to crisis to treatment and services and to ongoing supports. And but the crisis piece of the continuum was really being hit hard. And I'm sure you all have talked to police chiefs for years saying the number of mental health calls that we are responding to are going up and up and up. And we don't feel as equipped as we need to be to respond to those calls. So Dakota County worked with our local law enforcement agencies and embedded a social worker with 10 out of 12 law enforcement agencies. These social workers go out on calls. These social workers sometimes go out instead of law enforcement if law enforcement deems that it is better to have a social work intervention than a law enforcement intervention. And anybody who spent 5 minutes with me in this committee has heard me say, it's so important for people to get the care they need when they need it. And this is a program that does just that. It puts people, it makes sure that we are not putting people into the law enforcement system, the correctional system, into hospitalization, but getting them the care that they need exactly when they need it. And so, what we are here today is asking for your support as long-term sources of funding are being built around this idea that Dakota County has worked on, and I know that other counties are looking to engage in. So the department is working on restructuring crisis funding, and we feel really good about where that's going and where those conversations are going. However, we're also very aware that there's going to be a gap in funding from what we as a county have been able to fund and when the more long-term sources of funding are coming. And so that's why we're in front of you today to ask for this $3.4 million appropriation so that we can fund this gap in our funding while continuing to build the program. I think that it's been so successful and we continue to adjust and work with our law enforcement agencies to improve, to provide additional supports. And honestly, our crisis team has provided supports to our agencies as well. We know that trauma and among first responders is also an issue, and we've seen that firsthand. And so these folks are providing great work. If you get to spend time with them, it's pretty inspiring to see how much they love what they do. These are experienced social workers that are on the job, and I'm really proud of the professionalism that they're bringing to another branch of first responding, if you will. And I'll just tell you a brief story about one way that this played out recently, in that our law enforcement agency brought a social worker along for an intervention with a suicidal 14-year-old girl. It was high stakes. She was on a bridge. She was going to jump. And this social worker was able to engage, and after many, many hours of work, talk her down. And not only was she down and she was safe, she was brought into a treatment program. And so there was a seamless handoff that we need so much, so that there wasn't further decompensation. This young woman was given the treatment that she needed immediately so that she didn't continue to get sicker. She was on the road to healing immediately. And that to me is such a success story. And it's one of thousands that we have heard from our law enforcement agencies. And so I humbly ask, I know that resources are small around here, and I humbly ask for support for us to continue to build this program while state funding is put in place for broader supports. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner.
And I'll tell you, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt. Mr. Hanspeter is here to answer any questions you have.
Well stated. That saves us some time here. thank you, Commissioner. Member discussions. Any questions? Lead Newburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is actually probably for you, Mr. Chair, because I think that we all understand the concerns that you're trying to address here. I don't think that's a question. My question is, there is, jurisdiction is a little wonky when it comes to human services budget. And so I'm wondering, I think the motion is to send this to health. And so the jurisdiction is a little wonky when it comes to human services budget, but this appropriation is going into the base. So this is $3.4 million additional spending going into the base. The current deficit, the current future deficit is $1.478 billion, and this is adding directly to that if we choose to do this bill. But when it comes to, I understand there are jurisdictional issues, so I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if you have a target for our committee for human services spending.
We haven't received any target as of today,
okay.
But if when we get it, you will be the first person to know. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So and Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Or whoever wants to respond to this. The intention of this bill is that it's a one-time appropriation, not ongoing funding.
Just wanted to check with the nonpartisan staff as well.
Okay.
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair and members. The way this is written as a appropriation in the second year of the biennium, which if it went forward that way with nothing else would be scored as an ongoing appropriation. Listening to them and reading the bill, I suspect they meant it to be a one-time appropriation. So it should then say on line 1.10 after the period, this is a one-time appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
Chair
Newer, representatives, that is our intention, is to ask for a one-time appropriation really to bridge to longer-term sustainable funding as the Department of Human Services works on crisis funding and how to make sure communities like ours are getting funded appropriately.
So I think that will be in the next committee to address that issue when it comes
I'll hear
to the
it there
health.
Too.
Yep, you'll hear it there. Representative Kiara.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I was actually kind of wondering the same question. Language does kind of matter, so I'm glad you caught that. Mental health is so important. We talk about it a lot. The one thing I kind of always say is the state does have 988. It is really important that all of our communities know and understand that it is a suicide prevention support hotline that we have in the state. I just feel like as an advocate for mental health, we always have to acknowledge that we do have that system in our state. But I love this, and I also love seeing that it's a bipartisan bill around supporting mental health. So good work on that. Thank you.
Any other member? Seeing none, your closing remarks?
Well, I think everything's really been said. It's amazing that all these organizations are able to work collaboratively because it is a whole community issue and can be a whole community solution, too. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Fadi renews her motion that House File 4883 be re-referred to Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. You're on your way to the Health, Finance, and Policy. The next bill we have is House File 4940. Our testifiers can can sit there because they're on the next bill. It's Dakota County Day here in Human Services Finance. Representative Vanik, while you are having a seat, I'll move that House File 4940 for you to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please present your bill and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Before you is House File 4940, a bill brought forth by Dakota County that addresses the workforce shortages and improves service delivery through a two-year Communities for All pilot program and the development of a gig economy-style online application to match support requests with available staff. As we all know, people with disabilities and their families are being impacted by a shortage of support staff and services to help them live and work in the community. Staff shortages have been described as a crisis in Minnesota for at least a decade, and the pandemic made the problem worse. In discussions with Dakota County, I understand they and other counties are seeing a significant growth in the number of people seeking and eligible for services, while at the same time, state data shows fewer people are working as direct support professionals. We know there are multiple issues at play here, including the need to pay direct support professionals a living wage, which we heard about multiple times, and to make sure this is a profession with a career and or ladders so people can stick with it. And I was thrilled to author this bill because I have seen Dakota County approaching this issue with a recognition that the overall workforce isn't expected to grow much. It takes about 22 years to get a worker over the next 30 years, so we need to be innovative. This bill would provide a direct allocation to Dakota County to pilot innovative approaches to addressing workforce challenges in disability services, with the goal that the whole state can benefit from what is learned, and we all work to tackle the staffing shortages from multiple angles. Today I have with me the respected former representative and now County Commissioner, Lori Halverson, to testify.
Welcome back, Commissioner. Please proceed with the testimony. Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Noor, members of the committee. Thanks for continuing to hear from me. I am Lori Halverson, Dakota County Commissioner, and I'm joined once again by Evan Hens-Peter, Director of Social Services in Dakota County. Our theme today is innovation, and the way that the state of Minnesota handles social services is that we have 87 communities that provide services around the state. And I think one of the benefits of that is that ideas and innovation really can grow from those 87 different counties that are doing this work. And here we are with an idea from Dakota County. Dakota County has been acutely aware of the high stakes with regard to the provider shortfall that people with disabilities are experiencing. And this has been going on for many years. And the same old answers aren't cutting it. So to that end, we as Dakota County convened an interdisciplinary work group, including providers of services, including private sector, including the faith community, and of course, people with lived experiences, families and people with disabilities that are experiencing these shortfalls. And the focus was really to find what we can do at the county to mitigate issues around the provider shortfall. And we got a lot of ideas from this group, and those ideas are being rolled out. But there were also some ideas that really had much more of a statewide flavor, and that is what brings us here today. So as you know, shortages in disability services are only getting worse, and people are experiencing real harm from these shortfalls. It includes longer wait lists for services, concerns about the service quality, and growing number of people with disabilities being forced into institutional care instead of community settings. It's also vitally important that people with disabilities can live, work, and play in our communities. And we need to increase community supports that create not just accommodation, but true belonging for our friends and our families and our neighbors who are living with disabilities. In November of, I told you about that already, convening our staff and provider shortage work group. And we recognized that Minnesota's long-term workforce outcome. We focused on trying to be innovative. And one of the innovations that this work group brought forward is engaging the broader community beyond just disability services organization to say, we've got an untapped resource. And it could be the churches, it could be the community organizations like the YMCA, places that people want to be and gather and experience community. And by the county providing training, technical assistance, micro grants for equipment, we could take organizations that are currently not very accessible or not very disability friendly, not by intention, but maybe by a lack of understanding, and make those natural supports grow around our communities in Dakota County. And that could really help reduce the need for intensive care services if people could be in community with natural supports. And so we are looking to expand options for how people can get that support and create more inclusive communities. And so this part of this ask is a $500,000 allocation to pilot a 2 years community for all to test this idea. Another idea and innovative idea that we're recommending by the work group is to develop an online application. I think that COVID gave us a lot of what ifs, right? Frankly, the disability community was looking for ways to participate remotely in work and community. And all of a sudden, when all of us obviously needed it during COVID, all of a sudden those kind of resources and availability of technology was there. So we talked about how can we leverage technology to make connection to services much more self-directed and much more available for people. Looking at the way services are being needed, you don't necessarily need a service provider every day, all day. But for example, housekeeping services, having somebody come in and get your day started and get you out the door is a big deal. We heard from a social worker with a disability who has to miss work, you know, because she doesn't have that person to get her out the door. And so if she could, you know, have a way through an application to search for available staff, if her worker calls in sick, she could do that. Or if somebody needed, you know, help with gardening, help with housekeeping, that doesn't necessarily have to be an ongoing service. It could be an occasional service. If they needed a driver, which apps like this kind of have been built around driving. And so Dakota County has reached out to other partners, and we have estimated that with 1.5 million, we could get an app off the ground, and we could do all the research to find out what it would take, how you built in safety and security, how you find provider options. And so to that end, we are asking the state to support this effort with a $500,000 allocation to Dakota County to develop and test an application for future expansion across the states. Both of these pilots will be funded with the state money that we're asking for in a combination of county and other grant money. And at the end, we anticipate that we will have workable solutions that will make it more possible for people with disabilities to direct their own opportunities and to belong in communities. Thank you so much for your time and attention. And again, Mr. Henspeter is here to provide the expertise and answer your questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have member questions. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand the intent. My issue is that there's a variety of communities across this state. And if we're going to do a pilot and develop an app, we really need to have probably at least three different counties in different parts of the state so that we can have it flexible and useful enough for more than just targeted at one county, because too often we do metro solutions and they don't work in greater Minnesota. So if we're having this held over, I would hope there would be work to actually have a better statewide approach to this activity than having a county driving this. because it's a statewide issue. So that's my input. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Neuer, Representative, I appreciate that comment. That's something that we've wrestled with through this process is, you know, this is a statewide issue and it looks different in every community and there won't be one-size-fits-all approaches. You know, we often act as an incubator in counties and in Dakota County in particular, we have a reputation of being willing to just try things that are different ideas that are outside of the box and see what we can learn and then see how we can expand it elsewhere. I will say with the idea of the application, that is something that we've had some conversations with Department of Human Services staff about as well, because it's come up in other work groups across the state related to this issue as well. And so we would certainly be happy to continue those conversations and see if there's a way to test this where multiple communities across the state have an opportunity to see how it works or doesn't work for them. But we do have a lot of momentum in Dakota County related to the idea. As Commissioner Halverson mentioned, we have partners that are ready to work with us on it, so we'd love to give it a try.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much for this bill. The workforce shortage is a major issue, and although not exactly the same, especially not an application for the second part, but similarly to the first part, we do have Direct Support Connect in the state of Minnesota, which is just PCA, right? It's just a small little bite of this apple. But I do think this idea that that could be expanded and look differently is really, really interesting. And I think it's a great opportunity to start the conversation about how do we take that platform and use it in a way that's working better for folks, since that is statewide and does have the ability to find a provider that meets your needs. And it is hiring, right? It's not the pool kind of concept. But I do think it's a great first step. And I think using the building blocks we have and bringing in innovation is a wonderful piece of that. So anytime I have an opportunity to plug Direct Support Connect for people who are seeking services or seeking an opportunity to support others that maybe aren't not aware of it, I take it. It's a wonderful website where you can put an application, you know, put that you're looking to support someone or that you're seeking support. And the more people who join it, the better chance we're going to have of finding matches. So.
Right. Representative Zelesnikar.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative, for the bill. As I sit and listen to this bill and the bills today, I mean, the needs are just endless. And I concur we have mental health and we have to lift up people in the way we can. My concern is just when I listen to you about, you know, innovation is needed to leverage technology, and I sit and reflect that we've had over 100 million in bills just today, and we have a deficit we're going into, structural imbalance deficit the same. But it strikes me that we're not talking about the $80 million needed for the SSIS IT, which delivers child protection, disability, foster care, adult maltreatment reporting, all these things that we run all these programs through. We are not talking at all about the infrastructure. So from my perspective, if we were going to do a one-time thing, if we had one-time money, we need to have support for 87 counties to protect the people of this state, to make sure we don't have fraud and we have systems of compliance and we have databases talking and we have social workers that can do their phone documentation and have a system that is interactive without losing all their data. We are not accomplishing anything without that program. And so we're talking about initiating all these carts and we still don't have the horse. We haven't talked about the horse one time. So I just leave this saying, I'm very worried about that. If all these bills pass, we still don't have the horse for the counties. And this has been going on. It's a 25-year-old system, one I started with when I entered the workforce 30 years ago, and it's the same one they're using. So I say this with wholeheartedness. We have a system failure that is bigger than the topics here, and it's the IT. So I hope that will be seriously considered, because that would be one-time money that would make sense to be supportive. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I think once we talk about the systems, it's just a big reminder. Hopefully we can get the MMIS, PRISM, SSIS, MAXIS, MEC Square, all the systems that we use to really move forward. So I think Representative Vining, did you want to say anything?
Oh, I do want to say something. I'm so sorry. Thank you for the comment, Representative Zalesnikar. Friday, we had Dakota County in to talk about a bill that I have on IT modernization from the county's perspective. And so it is a bill out there that is very near and dear to my heart. I would love for you to be part of that, whether it's SSIS, Maxis, MinChoices 2.0, you know, any of those. I 100% agree with you. I just got a hearing for this one first. So.
Representative Killa.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to second the plug for SSIS because we do need that. I'm glad you brought that up and technology supports. I'm also going to kind of go off of Representative Quam's. I know, right? Is the idea of really successful pilot programs in the state. I do think we need to take a couple communities into account for that and how we can do that, because you're right. Dakota County is one type of county. Clay County, here's my pitch, right, is that we're a border city kind of dealing with the same issues, so our things look different. And then rural communities also look very, very different in this. And so that's kind of all. You guys, like, teed me up as a softball player I am to try to hit some things home, and I like that idea. And I do think that when we do pilots like this, taking a couple different communities into play and how we can partner with each other is really powerful in one-time money. And so I just wanted to give that kind of plug and promotion that I am sure my county would love to be a partner with you, especially when it comes to supporting this effort. Thank you.
Lee New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question and then one comment. Lots of titles keep running through my head. Chair, Rep, Commissioner Halverson. You answered my question right at the end of your comments on match from the county, and it sounds like you intend for other sources of funding to be used along with this. Any idea to the commissioners, to your testifiers, or Representative Verning, any idea of how much money you think in total it's going to take to do this?
Director.
Chair Neuer, Representative, there's two different things going on here, two different pilots. For the application development, we've been working with a provider organization that actually approached us right around the same time our work group was coming up with this idea and said, we've wanted to do this for a really long time and we've really thought it through. And they're working with a software developer. They had a lot of homework done. And we worked with them on that, had several meetings. We believe that it will take about $1.5 million to develop something viable to test for not everything, but likely we'll choose one service that people can receive through the Department of Human Services and test it with that, and test it with folks that are background checked and trained to provide that service and people who are accessing that service. So $1.5 million is the total price tag, we believe, to do a pilot. Develop a viable product that can be tested with a smaller group, and then from there, of course, it'd be a bigger question about scaling and next, what comes next.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I actually think this is really interesting, and I love hearing that, because you're coming to the state for a relatively small portion of this relatively small need, right? And I appreciate that. I also view this, I mean, the workforce challenges we have in disability services are monumental. And so I also think that is a really big deal. And in fact, the chair and I have had conversations about other issues that we need to be really cautious in other areas of what we do to not inadvertently hurt our workforce in disability, which is possible with some of the other problems we need to solve. So it's a complicated issue, and I love innovation. I love trying different things. I feel like this is going towards identifying how to solve needs in essential services. All of that is wonderful, and yet, last year, you know, we talk about this IT problem. Last year, we had almost $30 billion. We actually could have solved a whole problem. We actually could have redesigned and developed the entire IT system in the social services space. And we didn't. We didn't. With almost $30 billion, we didn't do it. And now we're coming back and saying, hey, can we have another million that's going to add to the bottom line of our deficit? That's what we're doing with this bill. It's a great idea. I love pilot projects. I love innovation and trying different things. But once again, we no longer have the money. Last year, we had almost $30 billion to actually solve problems. Like, solve entire problems, not just fiddle around the edges. And while what you're proposing sounds really interesting, it's the timing is unfortunate because there's no money. So I have to be opposed for that reason. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Supervisor from Vice Chair.
Thank you. First, I want to say thank you for obviously trying to be innovative and modernize. You know, with as a 30-year veteran of IT, that is my wheelhouse. And what I really appreciate around this table is Representative Zalesnikar, Lee New Brindley, Representative Varnig, we have Representative Hicks, Chair Noor, and myself are all in a bipartisan fashion, excited about IT modernization. That is a thrilling topic. And I am hoping that we continue that spirit as we move forward into the future, as we get more money. But I do want to just say briefly on the modernization, there are folks at Minute, folks at the Governor's Technical Advisory Committee on IT have been having deep dive conversations on these very topics, on how we modernize our internal systems for the state, for our counties, for our local folks. And by the way, I have some really great bills on cybersecurity that work with counties and local governments, as well as school districts, so I hope you will all support it.
Thank you. Any closing remarks?
Before our esteemed author takes the mic, I did want to just thank this committee for the conversation. I'm glad you all are as excited about modernization of IT as we are. If you have interest in seeing the presentation that Dakota County did for Representative Varnig, we did record it. So there are very few people who'd get excited about spending their time watching
please
this.
Share with us.
They're in this room, I can tell you. And so get in touch with me or with Representative Varnig, and we can help fill your days and nights with exciting video presentation
around
that.
Just listen to it as we go home.
There you go. The other thing I want to thank you all on is thanks for thinking creatively. Thanks for thinking bigger. Thanks for asking us to think bigger. Dakota County, I often say, is we're kind of like a little Minnesota in that we are urban, we are suburban, we are rural. Well, urban's a stretch, but we have, you know, the eighth and ninth largest cities in the state, so we'll take it. We are kind of a nice microcosm, but I also think that we definitely share your vision in how do we share what we know together and make these changes together. So thanks for thinking bigger.
All right.
Representative Brennan.
Thank you, Chair. I wasn't here last year, so I didn't get to be part of the $30 billion budget, so this is my chance to come ask, right? This is a great use of braided funding and brings us one step forward to listening to the recommendations of the work group and supporting our community members with disabilities with innovative solutions to disability services and workforce shortages. Thanks for your consideration of House File 4940.
Indeed, Representative Varnig, you missed all the good things that we did last year. So with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 4940 be laid over. We don't have any further agenda items. We are now adjourned.